host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockey PDOcast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me for this special two-part edition of the PDOcast, where we are going to preview every single round one series ahead of the start of this 2024 postseason, is my good buddy, Jack Hahn. Jack, what's going on, man?
Yes, we're here. We got so much to cover. Let's get going right now.
We're going to have a good time. Also joining us is another Jack. Every Jack that I know is here. Our pal, Jack Fraser. Jack, what's going on, man?
I'm halfway through my playoff previews, so I am totally ready to speak about a heck of a lot of hockey that we're going to be watching in the next couple of weeks.
Awesome. Well, this is going to be fun. Since I'm joined by two Jacks today, I'll be calling you guys by your last names just for the sake of simplicity and so you guys know who I'm talking to. But we're going to have a fun three-way chat here, and the playoffs are upon us. They kick off on Saturday, which means we're left with quite a quick turnaround here to get ready for the festivities. So today the goal is for us to do our best to help everyone get ready for Saturday. We're going to hopefully load you up with everything you need to know when watching these games. The three of us got together last year for this very exercise, and it was a great time. If you ever question our commitment to the content and to bring in the goods for you guys, I believe our pal Jack on here was like sitting in his car outside the hospital waiting for his partner to give birth to their first baby. But he was like, I'm not missing the show. We're going to do it. So this year it'll be more chill circumstances, certainly, but we're still going to have a lot of fun. And I think what I want the three of us to do here today in particular, in bringing the band back together, is to sort of dig a bit past the usual narratives and sort of just hearing people give their picks on every one of these preview shows. I want us to identify strengths, weaknesses, exploitable matchups, things to watch for, and kind of keys to victory for each of these series in round one. And so we've got 2 hours to do so here today. We're going to split them up by conference. We're going to start off with the West. And with all that out of the way, Jack Fraser, I will give you the floor here first. I want to start off with talking about this Winnipeg Jets Colorado Avalanche series, which for my money is arguably the most interesting round one matchup for me. It certainly doesn't have sort of the buzz of Leafs, Bruins, or even the Battle of Florida. But from an X's and O's perspective in particular, I feel like this is such a fascinating matchup. I can't wait to see these games. And so I know you've already written about this series for EP Ringside, so I'll give you the floor here. What's the most interesting component of this for you, and kind of what are you looking for between these two teams?
Yeah, I really can't wait for this series. I think it's maybe the tightest one that we could forecast, which there's a lot of, you know, you talk about the narratives going around. People watch a 7-0 game a week before the season ends, and they think that everything is just going to be lopsided like the regular season matchups. But man, I think this is going to be an amazing battle. People tend to, I think, out of habit, say that the Winnipeg Jets, oh, they're just a product of Connor Hellebuck. You know, their defense is not very strong. But I think the most interesting thing about this matchup is going to be seeing that Winnipeg Jets defense, which is really good. You know, like it has a lot of pieces up and down the lineup that can really contribute defensively. They've improved a huge amount, and they're going to be taking on a Colorado Avalanche team that I think has done a lot of things to balance out their depth across the lineup. Whether they can get into those dangerous areas and actually test Hellebuck will remain to be seen. I mean, man, the Winnipeg Jets, if they can get past this Colorado team and really establish themselves, and especially if they can get the offense going, you know, if they can, well, I mean, deploy their offensive pieces in the appropriate way against Colorado, I think they have a really serious chance of making a deep run here. And I'm really excited to see what the Jets are able to do, especially faced off against the bulldozer that is Nathan MacKinnon in the postseason.
Jack Hahn, I think what's so interesting about this and why I'm so captivated by it is because it's two, as Jack alluded to here, evenly matched teams, but I think their idea, respectively, of what a good time is wildly different. And you see that in the way they play and kind of what they're trying to accomplish. And this sort of power struggle, I guess, for trying to figure out who's going to control those playing conditions and watching these games unfold is what I can't wait to see. And sort of, I'm not sure what your take on this, Hahn, is, but like the common theme, I think, throughout these matchups for us today is going to be, I necessarily don't think that the regular season head-to-heads particularly matter come the postseason, particularly when, like in this one, for example, two of the three games they've played this year happened in early December when both these teams just looked dramatically different from a personnel perspective. At the same time, though, we saw this matchup recently between these two teams. Winnipeg won 7-0. And not only was it an emphatic thumping on their part, but it was a decisive game because from a practical perspective, it gave Winnipeg home ice in this series. And from a matchups perspective, as we try to figure out how this is going to work and map it out, I think that actually does play a big role in this in terms of how Winnipeg is going to construct their defense to try to slow down Nathan MacKinnon as best they can.
So I like the Jets in this series, and like, I'm not putting a whole lot of value on that 7-0 game, but just in general, I get really nervous whenever I think about Colorado's goaltending. I'm not a goalie guy, but I mean, it's pretty much sort of the two polar opposites, right? Like Hellebuck as the guy who's really sort of the known quality, whereas, you know, Georgiev or Noonan, or maybe even we see Prozvatov in this series. Like, I just think there's a lot of question marks. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, I've been watching a lot of Devon Taves and Cale Makar recently, and, you know, still one of the best two-way or, you know, even offense-generating D pairs in the league. But in the D zone, I just feel like they've kind of lost half a step, or they're not really as aggressive as they have been at killing plays. And I wonder if that's going to be an issue against some of these Winnipeg Jets players who are really heavy and like to play down low and like to play off the cycle. You know, Vilardi, hopefully he's going to be healthy and he's going to be a big part of what the Jets are trying to do, whether it's on the power play or at 5-on-5. Monahan is a great inside player, especially on the power play. And then Tyler Toffoli is another guy who's really nifty off the cycle at finding soft spots. So if the Jets are able to keep the play at either a slow or at a medium pace so that they don't get run off the ice, and, you know, they get some saves and they're able to kind of ground and pound and play in the AV zone, I like their odds.
I do too. Fraser, it's interesting. Yeah. This kind of goalie battle, because I think obviously on paper, everyone's sort of leaning on that as like, well, Hellebuck is going to win. Vezina, he's going to get Hart votes. He has a 921 save percentage, nearly 30 goal save above expected. He is a known commodity and everyone knows how elite he is. Georgiev has a sub 900 save percentage. Sporlogic's model has him looking a bit better, I think, than the public ones. They've got him at about a -4 goal save above expected. But I had this chat with Kevin Woodley the other day, sort of trying to figure out how much of a limiting factor this was for a long Avalanche playoff run. And in watching them since, it's kind of reinforced some of my concerns, and they actually extend beyond the goaltending. Like, I think it's very obvious when you watch Georgiev play right now, he looks very shaky. It seems like every time he's asked to do something, he's like kind of fumbling the puck around. He can't corral rebounds. It, like, visibly, even to an untrained eye, doesn't look like a confident, reliable goalie. But my bigger concern extending beyond that is what Han just mentioned there, the defensive play in front of him. Like, this Avalanche team is not boxing out in front of him. They're not clearing rebounds. Every time he makes a mistake, they're kind of compounding it. And so for a struggling goalie, that battle for prime real estate in front of him is going to be the key matchup here for me, beyond just the two goalies themselves, because Winnipeg, as we talked about here, is such a heavy team that wins those battles and does a lot of their damage from in front of the net. And this Avalanche team defensively has not done well at boxing out there. They give up a ton of inner slot shots. And so if they're unable to sort of make life a bit easier for Georgiev, I don't really care how he's performing himself, because that just seems like it's going to be a nightmare matchup for them on paper. And that might be the difference in the series.
Yeah, it really is a dual factor, because like you said, I mean, guys like, you know, even their more skilled guys, like even guys like Niederreiter and Vilardi and Toffoli, like they you know, really like to pound shots from close by the net, and the Avalanche really not so good at clearing them out. I mean, not only allowing shots in the inner slot, but a lot of rebounds, a lot of deflections, like stuff that's going on in the net front. But, you know, a thing that I like about the Jets is that they have a balanced enough offense that it really isn't just about kind of pounding shots in from you know, inside the slot. You know, they also have the effective rush offense as well. And that's where I get a little bit concerned about the defensive depth for Colorado, because especially late on, anybody who's been paired up with Jack Johnson and especially Sean Walker, I mean, that pairing has really been a nightmare ever since Walker got acquired at the deadline. You know, depending on how they choose to construct their blue line, I see the chance that this, I think, pretty deep Winnipeg attack could just really victimize the bottom part of that Colorado lineup in a way that, you know, I think a lot of people might not even expect heading into the series.
On the Jets are ninth in inner slot shots. The Avs are 25th at giving up inner slot shots in terms of like giving up the most of them. And you watch that 7-0 game they played, Georgiev gets pulled after the four goals against early. Three of them, you go back and it's all of this stuff. It's like someone gets lost backdoor. There's a rebound that isn't cleared. There's another tip in or tap in. And it's stuff that even the best goalie in the world would kind of struggle with. And I think that's sort of expediting all of these otherwise underlying issues. And so Colorado needs to be much better defensively in your zone. And the reason why I bring that up is I was reading your hockey tactics manual that you put out recently in the Avalanche section in particular. And you had an interesting note in there about how like stylistically they're sort of extreme in terms of the way they defend in their zone when the puck is on the wall, in terms of like how they heavily overload towards the puck and defensemen wind up as a result being far from the net. And I think you see that sometimes here, and you know, they have success playing that way. So I'm not necessarily saying you're going to have to change that, but if you're the Winnipeg Jets team here, you kind of have to like that from a tactical perspective, because you have to feel confident watching all this tape and having played this team a few times that you're going to get these quality looks. Now it's just a matter of converting on them.
Yeah. And you know, you guys talk about the issue with the Jack Johnson, Sean Walker pairing. And this is one of the problems when you put a fast guy with a slow guy, because, you know, Jack Johnson is probably at this point one of the slowest players in the league, and he's playing on a very up-tempo team with a partner in Sean Walker who plays that up-tempo style. So whenever these two guys, they get dragged apart for whatever reason, then there's a lot of space between them for things to go wrong.
That's very true. Fraser, I want to talk about the matchups here, because I mentioned sort of this key for home ice and Winnipeg winning it. Not only does it mean that they don't have to start off the series in altitude and everything that comes with that, and obviously a game seven if this series goes that far, but they also secured the last change. And I think why that's important is Rick Bowness, I think, is for better or for worse, a big matchups guy as a coach. Particularly we've seen, especially when he was with Dallas, like he would actively seek out getting his best defensive players, guys like Radek Faksa, against the other team's most imminent scoring threat, their top line. Whereas Jared Bednar is a bit more laissez-faire with that. Like, especially he's just going to play his top players so much regardless that he's not overly bogged down with that. And so in trying to figure out how this series is going to work out for games one and two in particular to start off, I imagine we're going to see a heavy dose of Adam Lowry, who has been phenomenal defensively this season, and also this Morrissey-DeMello pairing. And just as importantly, I think that means that Winnipeg can kind of keep Kyle Connor and Mark Scheifele away from McKinnon, and then it can also keep that Neil Pionk pairing away from him. And the difference between like that forward defense combo, the one they're going to try to use, and the one that I think Colorado is going to exploit when they have last change, is almost about as big of a gap defensively as I think you're going to find. And so I try not to get too worried about these sorts of specific matchups, because, you know, there's so much stuff on the fly and there's ways to work around it. But I can't help but think that that's going to be kind of like a recurring thing when we watch these games, at least in Winnipeg, with them controlling last change.
Well, yeah, I mean, them being able to contain to a certain extent that McKinnon line is going to be so huge. And the thing is, like, even if they can't, like, we look at, you know, I guess a model for Winnipeg is going to be what Seattle did last year. Seattle, obviously, also a very strong defensive team. Winnipeg, obviously, more talented offensively, I think, and with a more reliable goaltender. But, you know, you look at what happened in that series against Seattle, you saw McKinnon and Rantanen basically running the show single-handed, putting up, you know, incredible numbers in terms of what they were able to generate, you know, scoring chances and things like that, and the rest of the lineup essentially being shut down. You know, I would imagine that the Jets might be willing to take a little bit of bleeding from that McKinnon-Rantanen line if they can win the rest of the matchups. And, you know, I mean, there's a reason, as frustrated as I was with it, that, you know, the models headed into the season, including my own, were so high on the Jets. And it's because the additions that they've made to that roster in the past, you know, 2 years or so, just to build out the depth of it, have been so hugely important. Like, you can have a guy like Nino Niederreiter, you can have Tyler Toffoli, and even Ehlers, depending on how far down the lineup he ends up, you know, Cole Perfetti on your fourth line, I guess. You know, Rick Bowness, there's obviously downsides to the way that he constructs his lines, but the upside of it might come out in this series where Winnipeg has the potential to win some forward matchups that you wouldn't necessarily expect them to if they played their top players in the minutes that we like to think that they deserve.
And if you were coaching in this series, let's say you put yourself in Rick Bowness' shoes, or you're one of his assistants and you're trying to devise a game plan for kind of corralling McKinnon a little bit, because he's going to play so much and he's going to get his looks regardless of what you do. You sort of have to live with that, but just making life difficult for him, getting a body on him, kind of trying to cut off his skating path to slow him down where you can, at least like kind of disrupt him a little bit. Obviously, like, Lowry is your best bet because of his range and his physicality. And you look at his results this season, like, they're giving up 1.2 goals against per 60 at 515 with him on the ice. He's been phenomenal and worthy, I think, of a Selke nomination. And then you, even the head-to-heads this series, this season between them, you've seen the differences of when Morrissey's out there against them versus when Pionk is, and it kind of illustrated that, how big of a gap that is. At the same time, though, like, I worry a little bit their Rick Bonus is going to go a bit too far down the path of, like, seeking that matchup out so specifically, and McKinnon's going to play so much that as a result, you wind up playing maybe a lesser option and foregoing using your top six. And then you get into a spot where you're sort of letting Colorado, even they don't have last change, dictate it, because all of a sudden now your two scoring lines aren't out there as much. You're playing essentially a checking line, very heavy minutes. And then you get into this kind of slow, low event game. And that might suit Winnipeg better, but also it's kind of a slippery slope when you're just hunting matchups that deliberately.
So yeah, like that is a danger. And I think it's the sort of the direction that maybe NHL coaches lean toward a little bit too much at times, but there are kind of two benefits to this. So first of all, is that when you play a player like Lowry against the McKinnon line, like, you're not really under pressure to score, right? For them, if they're able to tie their shifts and you know, tie that game, that portion of the game 0-0, they're really happy with it. So a lot of times what happens is the most dangerous scoring chances that you're going to give up are off of neutral zone turnovers. And if you have a guy like Lowry, who's more defense first, more of a checker, he's less likely to play with risk, right, on entries, because he knows that his game is dump and chase and just make sure that McKinnon stays out of the middle of the ice, that he doesn't get good pucks to play with. Whereas if you're playing, let's say, power on power, so if you're going, let's say, McDavid against McKinnon, for instance, well, both guys know that they still got to make plays, right? So maybe they kind of overcook it, or they misjudge their risk tolerance, and then all of a sudden there's a turnover off a middle entry, and then it's a 2-on-1 the other way. So when you have a defense first guy as your top matchup line, at least, you know, in a coach's mind, that kind of puts you a little bit more at ease. And then the second thing is, obviously, when you have a home ice advantage, it's a little bit easier to match lines. So for the uninitiated, there's two ways that NHL coaches go about their matchup. So first of all, it could be competition-based. So let's say the Lowry line gets the McKinnon line, and then the Scheifele line gets Mittelstadt, and then, you know, the third line, let's say Monahan's line, get, you know, whoever's left, and then the fourth line gets a few shifts here and there. Or you can do your deployments by zone, and this is a much better approach when you don't have last change, when you don't have home ice advantage. So let's say you can go Lowry gets every D zone start, because you don't really know who's coming over the boards for Colorado if they have last change. So if it's McKinnon, great. If it's Mittelstadt, fine. If it's somebody else, then, you know, you can quickly, maybe you can do a face-off and then a change to get somebody else on. In the O-zone, it's Scheifele's line, or maybe, you know, Edler's line. So when you don't have last change, then that's a more logical, a little bit more lower maintenance way to do that.
Well, Han, let me stick with you then, just to kind of follow up on that. If you're the Avalanche and you're Jared Bednar then, and let's say they're using Drouin with McKinnon and Rantanen, and then you've got sort of Nichushkin, Lekkonen, and Mittelstadt, although I kind of like splitting up Nichushkin and Lekkonen, because I think there's a bit of a overlap between their skill sets, and I'd rather have them on separate lines. But if you're trying to create some easy offense then in the middle six, while we're going to see a lot of Lowry versus McKinnon, it also opens an interesting option for you, I guess, to have those guys out against Kyle Connor and Mark Scheifele, who maybe play a bit more risky with the puck, in particular Connor, a lot of turnovers, and then sometimes a bit slow in getting back and defending in transition. And for guys who are such a buzzsaw off the forecheck and able to create turnovers the way Nichushkin and Lekkonen can, I imagine that presents an interesting opportunity then for Colorado to sort of turn the matchup game around on Winnipeg. Because, you know, Fraser was mentioning off the top that last year what Seattle did to McKinnon and Rantanen and how they treated that matchup, with the addition of Mittelstadt and when Nichushkin back and Lekkonen healthy, this Colorado Avalanche team does have more weapons and more ways to beat you than last year's version did. So I think we're sort of, I don't want to get too far down the path of acting like Colorado is just sort of this one trick pony, because they clearly have so many different options and weapons up front now. And so that might be an interesting way to kind of target evening the scales, I guess, or getting some extra opportunities for your team.
Well, that's why I think Mittelstadt is probably, for me, the player that's going to be the most important to the Avs in terms of the role that he's going to play. He's never played in the playoffs at the NHL level. He's a player who, unlike MacKinnon, has some fairly noticeable weaknesses in his game in terms of, you know, the pace at which he plays with, or, you know, he's not the most physical guy. He's not really a shooting threat. He's more of a playmaker. You can't really stop MacKinnon. You can only wish to contain him. But certainly, I think if you study the tape and you try a few things, you can definitely neutralize Mittelstadt. And once that happens, or if that happens, then Colorado starts looking like a team that's really low on depth. And then they're going to have to overplay MacKinnon, overplay Makar and Taves, or, you know, try different things. And maybe that's not going to work out necessarily. And really, I think it's in the middle six where the Winnipeg Jets can really kind of make hay in the series.
I think so too. Fraser, I want to end on the series because we still have to bounce around and do the three other West ones, of course. But I guess as my parting shot, I'm curious for your take on this. Like, on the one hand, I think the highs of Winnipeg this year, like when they've been at their best, have been clearly very impressive. And defensively, they just don't give you much. At the same time, I've seen them sort of when they're at their worst, like when they look very miserable and very beatable and slow and almost like an entirely different team. So I think there's two polar extremes there. And the other thing that I'm sort of wrestling with in this, because I'm with you that Winnipeg is kind of uniquely positioned to give Colorado some trouble in this matchup, is I just don't know what to do with this late season sample. And that applies to everyone, but I think especially for Colorado, right? Because they've had some stinkers here down the stretch. You know, Dallas did pretty much whatever they wanted against them offensively. Edmonton put up 6 goals on them. Winnipeg beat them 7-0. They blew that Vegas game. Like, these are some sort of like high, like big spotlight games that you'd think they would get their best, and their performance lagged behind. But I also think we know what this team is, and at their best, how good they can be. And sort of, I'm wondering what the motivation or what the inspiration was like at the end of the season, and whether once the playoffs start, they're going to kind of flip that switch or look like just a different team. Because after the deadline, they certainly looked very dangerous. And I don't know how to sort of weigh that in comparison to whatever the past 5 to 10 games from them have looked like.
Well, yeah, these teams kind of had opposing runs, right? Because the Jets had a bit of a tough go, and then suddenly they were 7-0-0. And then the Avalanche were on a 9-game winning streak, and then they go 3-4-2. I mean, like, it's one reason that I don't like to look too closely at things that are happening at the end of the season, just because there's so much noise. And, you know, I mean, you look at the difference between the goals and the expected goals and shots for both of those streaks. There's obviously a lot of noise going on there. But I do agree that, you know, this Jets team has been a little streaky. You know, you look at their statistical profile and they look like a team that should be like the most stable, confidence inducing squad. You know, they have these incredible defensive numbers across the board. Their offensive numbers are great. They have a Vezina, a goalie who's going to be a 2-time Vezina winner in a couple months. And yet we're sitting here, you know, rubbing our hands together, kind of figuring out exactly how good they are. And maybe this is the series where they finally put that to rest and they're like, no, we are a legitimate cup contender. Jack was right at the beginning of the season. We're amazing. But I feel you in that kind of level of uncertainty. And it's one that, even though we've seen the Avs, you know, just a year ago lose out in the first round, I don't have quite that lack of confidence in Colorado, just in terms of whether they're going to show up. Whereas the Jets, I feel like, have that higher ceiling, but maybe a potentially lower floor.
Yeah, I feel like their fastball, Colorado's, is still terrifying. And I think we could see that certainly in this series. And that's what, I don't want to be too confident in the Jets and their outlook here, because I can't help but think there's going to be at least a game or two throughout these seven where, you know, the Avs are just breaking through offensively off the rush, scoring a bunch. And then I'm looking at natural stat trick and seeing Mason Appleton having played like 3 more minutes than Nikolaj Ehlers, and just being incredibly frustrated and sort of beating myself up for not seeing that coming. Han, do you have any other parting notes on this series, or do you want to move on to the next one?
I don't want to if I'm the Avs, I'd be terrified about getting Jack Johnson out there against Nick Ehlers on the third line. That's all I'm going to say.
I would be terrified about getting any other defenseman out there against Nick Ehlers because he's that much of a matchup problem. All right, let's take a break here. And then when we come back, we're going to jump right back into the other West series and break them down the way we did this one. Looking forward to it, guys. You're listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network. All right, we're back here on the Hockey PDOcast. Off to a rollicking start. The three of us got together. We said we're going to get through all these West matchups in 50 minutes, and then we spent 25 minutes or so on Jets Avalanche. So we're going to have to speed around here. But Han, I'll give you the floor here. Let's talk Canucks Predators, because that's the other West series that we've got already solidified as we record this here. And I think it's a very interesting one because there are two teams that theoretically you think about them and you're like, all right, they're not that similar. But then when you get into their statistical resumes, at least a little bit, I think I can paint a very compelling picture about how they can sort of frustrate each other in very similar ways. So what are you looking for in this matchup and sort of what sticks out to you, at least from a tactical perspective right off the bat?
As a resident of Vancouver, if Nashville sweeps this series here, is the city going to burn down? That's my first question. I'll leave you to answer that. But the thing that I'm looking for is, you know, Vancouver at the start of the year, basically every shot they were taking off the rush was going in, and that wasn't really sustainable. But, you know, I watched them the past couple of days, and they're just like a classic, well-coached, well-structured, like, defensive team that hurts you on the counterattack. So it's not the sexiest way to play the game. Again, it's kind of a throwback, but they're making it work really well. And whereas Nashville, they're sort of this more new school, ozone high cycle, loss of player interchange, the D's are involved off the rush, not just Josi, but every D that they have. So a nice contrast in style, and it's going to be a nice series to watch for sure.
I think it's going to be a very entertaining one. Fraser, I've been on this, and you and I have been DMing about it, but I've certainly talked about it a bunch on this show, but I think it bears repeating because it really dictates, I think, my outlook for this series. And it's that while everyone all season has been fixated on the Canucks PDO, which predictably has regressed since the All-Star break, and I think they're almost at like a clean 100 shooting and save percentage combined of 5-on-5 since then, the most fortunate part of their campaign for me statistically has been the sequencing of their goal scoring specifically. You look in the first period, they're up 95-57. Second period, that margin shrinks significantly. Third period, they're almost even. And I think that's the perfect representation of score effects over the course of a game taking their toll. But it also reflects to me why they've been able to sort of get out to these early starts where I think they've scored the first goal of the game in the first 5 minutes of the game 20 plus times this season. And certainly kudos to Rick Tocchet, who I think has done a masterful job of sort of recognizing the personnel he has, how they need to play to be effective, and then designing the system and getting everyone to buy in. But also it's kind of an interesting thought exercise, I guess, because once they get into game situations where, let's say, Nashville jumps out to an early lead or kind of pushes them right off the bat, are the Canucks going to be able to open the game up and play more of a rush game and trade chances and sort of get into uncomfortable waters they haven't been in very often this season because they haven't had to? And that might very well happen. Like, I think the playoffs are an entirely different animal. Part of my concern about this strategy, the way they've played, is it's great on paper, and in the regular season, it's a bit easier to execute where you're catching teams that are tired or unprepared for the way you're going to come at them. And I think we've seen other coaches of teams sort of say as much after playing the Canucks, where they recognize that they're a very difficult to play against. Some guys have even said that they're the most difficult team they faced all season. In the playoffs, I'm pretty sure that the Predators are going to be prepared for it. They know they're playing them 4 to 7 times in a row. The effort level, like, there's going to be less of an edge because every team treats the playoffs like it's do or die every game. And so you're going to get an equal matchup from them in that regard. And so I'm just fascinated to see how that plays out if they're not able to get out the leads, because if they are, I feel very confident that they're going to be able to replicate what they did all season.
Yeah, I think a theme that is going to come up over the course of us talking about this stuff is I've been very surprised going over and doing these previews at the number of teams that seem to have, like you think of teams, though, they emulate the Stanley Cup champions. You know, the teams get faster after the Penguins win, they get heavier after the Lightning and Golden Knights win, things like that. The number of teams that are kind of putting up, you know, microstat profiles that look like the Carolina Hurricanes, a team that hasn't made the Stanley Cup finals in the Brendan Moore era, is kind of staring to me. And the Canucks, you know, at least at a glance, kind of match that profile. You know, a lot of the dump and chase, the forechecking, you know, like you said, teams come out of their games in the regular season and say, oh, that was the hardest working team that we played. You know, like you said, that's an edge that kind of diminishes. And the Canucks going back, you know, well beyond the season, going back all the way to Bruce Boudreau and going back to Travis Green, their problem has always been creating with speed. You know, they just never get involved in the rush game. Now, what Tocchet was able to do defensively and overall, I mean, he made, like you said, he made this team such a well-structured defensive squad, partially because of that kind of possession heavy style game that really pays off when you have the kind of buy-in that comes when you win your first 15 games or whatever they did. You know, they were able to stop the rush chances against, which was always the big issue when they were playing under Green and Boudreau. But they still don't create a lot of quantity off the rush. I question, you know, whether they necessarily have the personnel to do so. And that's an area that the Nashville Predators have actually had as a bit of a weakness this season, is at stopping teams that play against them with speed. And, you know, I wonder whether the Predators might actually be kind of a strong defensive matchup for what the Canucks are able to do. And like you said, will the Canucks be able to adjust if they're not necessarily able to crash the net, get to the inner slot, you know, get in rebounds? You know, rebound goals were such a huge part of their game this year. It could be something where suddenly those goals that we've seen going in all year aren't going in at the level that we thought. You know, especially if Saros can play at the level that we know that he's capable of. And the way is worth mentioning that he's done against the Carolina Hurricanes in the past, a team that was getting a lot of kind of low to high passes, trying to crash the net for rebounds. I'm just interested to see, like you said, what's going to happen if the Canucks are forced to, you know, if they have the game dictated to them rather than them dictating the terms themselves.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to be looking for, Han. I think it's so fascinating. I kind of said that they're stylistically the same, and then you said they're different. I think the ways they attack certainly are, particularly with like off the rush and in transition, all that. But the Canucks, the part of the why they've had success is getting out to these early leads, and then they're just able to hold on to the puck in the offensive zone and kind of grind away possessions. They're fourth in the league in offensive zone time. They eventually kind of wind up working their way into the inner slot, and then defensively, because they're not pushing as much offensively, they're able to get back. They're able to insulate their defensemen that might struggle with foot speed and make life easier for Demko in front of them. And that's worked a success for them. The issue is that this Predators team is also a very effort-based team. Like, all of their best stuff is rebound and forecheck chances where they're top five in each. They don't give up any offensive zone time to the other team because they're often the ones sort of keeping the opposition hemmed in with multiple efforts and rebounds and just keeping them sort of pinned there. And so I don't really know what to make of how these two teams are going to stack up with each other in that way, because they're essentially, even if it's through different means, trying to accomplish the same thing in terms of just spending as much time in the offensive zone as possible. And that's why I actually thought that people were sort of scared of Vegas, and we're going to talk more about them in a second here, but I thought they would be a good matchup for the Canucks, because not only did we see Vancouver kind of give them trouble in some of their head-to-heads late in the season, but also Vegas is a team that's very sort of comfortable and willing to let you keep possession in the offensive zone against them. And so the Canucks would have been able to play this game that they've had success with. Nashville is very aggressively going to try to prevent that. And so how these two teams line up in that way and who's able to win out is going to be so fascinating to watch for me.
Yeah, well, the reason why I think these two teams are fundamentally different is Vancouver loves to have the puck on the wall and just outwork you and then like chip the puck kind of through or over a defender, and then all of a sudden they get a 2-on-1 or all of a sudden they get something in the slot. Whereas Nashville, they're very methodical at getting off the wall, using the width of the ice, using player movement off the puck to retrieve, you know, on the weak side and retrieve shots. A lot of this like new school kind of offensive principles. So, you know, a lot of the things that Nashville does is by design, whereas a lot of what Vancouver does to create their best looks, they're sort of, they look like lucky plays or bounces, but really that's kind of how they create a lot of times. And I think, you know, it's not going to be pretty, but I think Vancouver, like, like in a playoffs setting where everything's kind of so locked down and there's not a lot of room to operate, you know, we're going to see Nashville try to string four or five passes in the offensive zone, and all of a sudden something goes wrong, and then Vancouver has this like 2-on-1. Like, and I think we're going to see some of that.
Yeah, I think we will as well. It's interesting, these two teams, speaking of the head-to-heads, like Vancouver kind of had their way with them. It was early in the season, like really early. And in particular, I went back and watched that, and Vancouver's forecheck sort of feasted against Nashville. I think that's not really representative, because not only has this Predators team played better, but it also makes sense that Andrew Brunette's system and how he wants them to play differently took a while for it to really kind of mesh and sink in. And you've seen with Roman Josi the final 30 games or so, he's fully bought in and played differently. And so this Predators team looks wildly different here in April than it did in October. Couple guys that I would throw out for Nashville to watch, because I think everyone gets like Josi and Forsberg, and that top line is good. Novak and Evangelista, the way they play in space and how they're willing to sort of challenge defenders, I think is going to give Vancouver's defense some problems. So I want to see that. Fraser, is there any sort of other X's and O's or specific matchups in this series that you're going to be watching or you think are notable to highlight here?
Well, I would just really like to see UC Saros string, a brilliant series together, because I mean, we've seen Demko do it in the playoffs before. I feel like this has the opportunity to be like one of the truly great goaltending battles of this playoffs. And I mean, Saros is so entertaining to watch when he's on. I think, like you said, the Canucks have had a lot of good fortune with sequencing over the course of the year. They've been able to score early in games and then sit on leads. You know, I would really like to see both teams kind of having to push through these lengthy tied games and just let kind of, you know, Demko and Saros, two of the best goaltenders in the league, really go head to head, because I can't really think of a goaltending matchup in these playoffs that would be, I think, more enjoyable to watch purely just the way the goaltenders play.
And especially on that note on Saros, who obviously everyone who listens know I'm quite a fan of, in this particular matchup, Vancouver creates so much of their offensive damage through like traffics and screens in front and attacking rebounds. And I'm curious to see how that plays out against the smallest goalie in the league in stature, because he's certainly going to have to fight through a lot of traffic and bodies just to sort of establish sight lines and see the puck. And so I want to see that over the course of a series. Han, do you have any other notes on these two teams? You and I have spoken about our Predators a lot this season, so I think a lot of your takes on them have already been documented, but just any other kind of final stuff here before we move on to the next teams?
Looking forward to seeing Tommy Novak as a real actual player in the playoffs. So let's see that.
I think you're going to see it, certainly. Okay, Fraser, let's do the Dallas Stars here. We're going to talk about them, the Golden Knights, the Kings, and the Oilers, and we're going to work through them one at a time because we're recording this on a Thursday evening. We still don't necessarily know the final matchups in the West, but I think we're going to highlight a lot of these similar strengths and weaknesses and matchups, and then people will be able to listen and sort of put two and two together in terms of how they line up with each other. What are you looking for with the Stars? What's impressed you? And do you think it's going to be trendy? Because I'm viewing them as my preliminary Stanley Cup pick, but I'm kind of fearing that that's going to be just a very regular take that a lot of people share.
Yeah, I'm afraid that the Dallas Stars are also my Stanley Cup pick. But in my defense, they were that before the season began, way back when Ryan Suter was the permanent pairing mate of Miro Heiskanen. I mean, I am just really excited to see the young Dallas Stars players. Like, I see a lot of potential for Logan Stankoven to be kind of like that Jake Gensel type guy who everybody's kind of vaguely aware of. He's doing really well so far in this season, but I would really love to see him just completely go off in this postseason. I mean, I love watching Chris Tanev. He has been great. He's been exactly what Dallas has needed from him, the perfect addition to their defense. And I think it really allows them to do a lot of the really fun things that they are capable of doing. You know, it just gives them so much more stability in the back end. Having him and Lindell both as shutdown players, I think, allows them to free up guys like Harley and Heiskanen a little bit more. But yeah, I think this is kind of a team whose time has come. If they can get the saves, if they can get the right playoff Ettinger, you know, it's going to be a popular pick for a reason. This is just an amazing team top to bottom. And once they really get the young kids going, you know, they could end up being almost unstoppable.
And it's remarkable to reflect on this team that made the Western Conference final last year and they decisively lost in the end to the eventual champion Golden Knights, but just how much they've optimized their usage and their personnel and their deployment of it ever since, right? Like, Ryan Suter was playing 23 and a half minutes for them last year. He's down to 17 now, all situations since Tanev came, and he's playing the third pair he's probably suited for at this point of his career. We've seen them take away Hakanpää's minutes as a result as well, because at that time they were essentially leaning on him and Lundell to be this defense pair that couldn't really handle the puck between either of them. And so it was a bit of a black hole offensively. Tanev's emergence has not only made that pair better, bumped everyone into their place, it's also allowed Heiskanen and Harley to play full-time together with extreme confidence. And we've seen them have 5-on-5 shares in the 60s across the board. So you have that. You have this fourth line with Craig Smith, Stan Steele, and Radek Faksa, which is actually giving them territorial victories, which they weren't getting last year when basically they were sending Glendening and Fox out there to try to accomplish nothing every time they were playing in a defensive zone. Stankoven and Johnston are just a walking high danger chance at this point, and they create so much themselves. You've got Duchesne sparking that second line as well off the rush. There's just so much to like here. What kind of stands out to you, and what are you looking for from the Dallas Stars in round one?
Well, I just think the Stars, I think they took the right lesson from last year's playoff loss, which is you come back the following season with better players. I mean, it all comes down to that, right? Like, they've upgraded. I mean, obviously the top of the lineup hasn't really changed. Pavelski has kind of lost his step this year being 40 years old. But aside from that, they've upgraded at every position, whether it's signing Duchesne, who was probably the best UFA signing last summer, who will likely be one of the worst UFA signings this summer, whether it's upgrading at the deadline with Tanev, whether it's promoting from within with Stankoven. And, you know, we've seen Maverick Bork get a handful of minutes here. And I think he's one of the best 13 forwards on any playoff team. Like, I just love these contending teams with a veteran core, but that elevate kids and rookies at this time of year, because they're coming in to play with no fear. Maybe, you know, you're putting them in some offensive opportunities so that they can get their rhythm going. But when I think about all the great teams in history, you know, like the dynasties and, you know, the Montreal Canadiens or the Islanders or the Edmonton Oilers, like a lot of those teams, like the fact that they have kids in their lineup got them over the hump at critical moments in the postseason. Because, you know, as much as it is important to be experienced and to have, you know, the veteran leadership and have, you know, big, strong players, a lot of times when you're in a rut, it's that youthful skill and speed and fearlessness that actually gets you over that hump.
Well, and particularly with Ottinger bouncing back over the past 10 games or so here, I was certainly concerned with him when he hit that nadir about a month ago. But since then, he's sort of worked his way back into form. You look in particular, his workload last year was way too much. Heading into the playoffs, they toned down quite a bit on that. So I think he's going to be holding up better this season. And so, Han, I'm curious for your take, like this team's versatility, the depth of options, the ways they can beat you. I was trying to think of a matchup that would give them some trouble in terms of like stylistically, or what you could force them to do playing wise that would give them problems and make them uncomfortable. Cause it feels like, at least looking on paper and watching them play, that they can beat you in so many different ways. They're comfortable playing any style of game, whether it's a slower one or whether it's speeding it up. They create high danger chances at such a high volume in different ways. It seems like this is the type of team that's set up for postseason success, right? Because along the way, they're going to have to play various different types of teams, and they're sort of positioned to do so, as opposed to being kind of this one team that's sort of boxed in. And if someone throws a surprising punch at them, they won't be able to handle it.
Well, I mean, like, I think Edmonton is probably a problematic matchup for them, as they would be for literally any other team in the league. Like, if McDavid and Draisaitl have their way and, you know, they win their minutes so handily that there's no chance that, you know, the other lines can catch up, then, you know, that could be it for Dallas.
It certainly could. Let's talk about the Golden Knights here before we move on to the Oilers. Fraser, I'll give you the floor here, because I'm curious for your take on how we evaluate this team, because it feels like a lot of it is sort of memories of what they were last year, theoretical what they could be based on the names on paper at full health. And I say that because we haven't really gotten to see this group at full strength. People have just been out of the lineup. We still don't know what Mark Stone's going to look like when he comes back. There's so many moving parts that I see why you'd be sort of hypothetically scared of them, because just the names involved are very terrifying, but also we haven't seen it yet. So it's still kind of this like relative unknown for me.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. I mean, you know, you look at the lineup on paper with everybody in it, and it looks scary because, I mean, you're essentially adding Tomas Hertl in place of Riley Smith, and you're, you know, plugging in Noah Hanifin onto a top pair of a team that already has Pietrangelo and Theodore. I mean, theoretically, this team should be great. And I know, not to say that they were necessarily bad in the regular season or anything, you know, obviously they had to deal with quite a few injuries, but, you know, I think they ultimately ended up being pretty okay in terms of their underlying profile. But I mean, the big question for me more than anything else is, you know, we know that Mark Stone is going to be probably quote unquote healthy pretty soon. But my question is just, what does that healthy look like? Because, you know, from a chance creation standpoint, I think this team has an awful lot of players who are pretty good. I don't think they have a lot of hugely weak links. You know, this team's identity from the get-go has been having players across the lineup who you can move up and down. That continues to be the case. But in terms of that kind of separation skill, you know, it really is Stone and Eichel. And Eichel has had to be a bit on an island oftentimes this year. If they get Mark Stone back and he's usual Mark Stone, like, you know, not only the amazing defensive player, but also, you know, maybe the most underrated passing winger, you know, of the past couple of years, then I think that adds a completely different element to this team. And that's something you have to legitimately be scared of. But if he comes back and, you know, he goes from being, you know, a bottom five skater in the league to, you know, an extra step behind that because, you know, his spleen is like half falling out of his body every time he takes a stride, then I think that that makes a huge difference. So, you know, Hanifin has been very good for them ever since he arrived. On paper, this team is strong. That's really the only question mark for me is whether Stone can add that other element or whether they're going to be kind of looking for somebody to come up big and coming up short.
Yeah, that is for me as well. Han, I'm curious for your take on that then, because I watched them play a couple games against the Canucks here recently where Vancouver gave them trouble with sort of preventing them from really getting moving and playing at their best, which is that sort of downhill rush game in transition and creating that way. They essentially sort of just like stuffed their breakouts and prevented them from ever really get going. And they kind of looked slow to me. Now, Stone is essentially their slowest player, but also if he comes back and he's at his best, he speeds them up so much because he fuels that transition. He's a bit of a connector for them where he creates a turnover and then immediately turns it into a counter opportunity. He takes a puck off the wall and he bumps it into the middle of the ice for a guy like Stevenson to use his speed and skate into it. And he makes just everyone so much better in that way. So I do think they need him because they have a lot of players who can play very specific styles, but he sort of puts that all together for them. Is that kind of your key here as well? Or do you have something beyond that, whether it's that or Hertl or Hanifin or how any of these other new pieces that are sort of still fitting in, match up with everything?
Well, first off, just looking at kind of like their macro sort of outputs, like they weren't a dominant team last year either, and they ended up going, you know, all the way and winning the cup. So certainly I don't think it's out of the realm of possibilities that they can go very deep. Also, again, you mentioned Hertl. Like, I love that acquisition for them, not only for this postseason, but just in the next couple of years, because he's like a true two-way center, even though he has that reputation of, you know, scoring between his legs and scoring four goals. But, you know, he's that like natural center who can help out defensively as well as create offensively. And I think if Vegas ever finds himself like in a tight spot and they need to put like a super line together, I think if they have, let's say, Eichel more on the wing and then Hertl down the middle, like as a true like top line, when they need a goal, I think that can be really effective.
Yeah, and you have already seen like just what a menace he is in terms of protecting the puck and his work in front of the net on that overtime winner against the Avs, just how picture perfect all of that was. So certainly already kind of rounding into form and showing his impact. I'm curious to see, like, this team's defensive game plan, Fraser, is so obvious, right? Like, and you talked about how teams like trying to copy it. They're 22nd in shots allowed. They're first in inner slot shots allowed again, despite all the missing players. Like, their strategy under Bruce Cassidy here is so crystallized and they execute it so well. But I'm curious to see what they do with their defense pairs, right? Because when they get everyone back here, are they going to still keep running this Hanifin and Hague pair? Are they going to put Hanifin back with Pietrangelo? Are they going to try to split it up so they have Hanifin, Pietrangelo, and Theodore out there at all times? I think they feel some level of sort of respect and attachment to Alec Martinez because of everything he's done for them and how good he was in the past and his role with Pietrangelo. But there's also an argument that at 37 years old right now, he might not even be one of their best six or seven defenders. And so I'm just curious to see how all these pieces kind of fit with everyone at full health on the blue line, how those pairs shake out. Because if it's a round one matchup against either Dallas or Edmonton, they're going to be challenged with a lot of speed. And all of a sudden, that's going to become something that like a light is firmly shined on.
Yeah, I mean, it's ironic that I'm looking across the league and looking at these rosters and thinking, you know, man, that two-team expansion has really taken an impact on the bottom sixes of, or especially the fourth lines of a lot of contending teams. And, you know, it's Vegas, one of the expansion teams themselves, who you think of them as being, you know, 13 forwards deep and seven defensemen. I mean, I think that's one of the great pieces of flexibility that acquiring Hanifin did for them is that, you know, a guy like Pietrangelo, a guy like, you know, to a lesser extent, or to an even greater extent, Martinez, you know, even McNabb, like you have these kind of older defensemen who are maybe coming along, and you're able to limit their minutes a little bit more. You know, it's not like, oh, we're either going to play him or we're going to play Shea Theodore, where maybe we're not sure if we want to really play Theodore in matchup minutes. You know, instead you kind of get to pick your slots a bit better. So I like the idea. You know, Hanifin Hag has been working. McNabb Theodore obviously has a whole lot of proof of concept. If they can get away with playing, you know, Whitecloud and Pietrangelo, and then just having Martinez as a guy who will come in when the inevitable injuries hit, or who they can even just kind of cycle in depending on how series seem to be going, whether they want, you know, end up needing a player who brings the kind of in-zone stability that a shot-blocking guy like Alec Martinez can, then they have that option. But you know, anytime that you can go three pairs deep, I think is very promising, especially because there aren't a lot of teams in the league that can do that. And you might actually get the most of a guy like Pietrangelo, who's played an awful lot of hockey in the last 5 years and isn't necessarily getting any younger. You know, you might even be able to maximize the output that you're getting from him.
Yeah, especially when your centers you're rocking down the middle are Eichel, Hertl, Carlson, and Nick Waugh. Not too bad. All right, let's take our break here. We're going to jump over to part two. We're going to do Oilers and Kings there as well, but we'll also highlight and brief preview all of the round one series in the East as well. So looking forward to that. You are listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network.